You were talking about the United, your perception of how the 1949 Ford came about as a sort of a fast-forward look at the career of several of your colleagues.
Yes. As I said, I was working at Chrysler, and this must have been about 1937. It was before I was married, and my mother lived with me in my apartment, and she
in Detroit,
and she worked for Winkelmann's, a store. Remember the ladies' apparel shop?
They just sold out to a conglomerate.
Is that right? And anyway, she was a sales lady at Winkelmann's, and one of the other sales ladies in Winkelmann's had a son. And she found out that my mother's son worked at Chrysler in the styling department. And she was very impressed. She said, "Oh, my son wants to get into to be an automobile designer. He wants to be an automobile. Oh my God! Okay, could we meet him? Could we meet him?" So mother told me, and I said, "Well, sure, and fine." And so set up a date, and they came over, he and his mother. Mm-hmm. And this happened to be Dick Calil.
C A L E A L.
I'm not sure how to spell it. I could check on it. I have he's in some article here in the magazine. So Dick and his mother came over and met him, and he was just crazy to get in the automobile design business. And I said, "Well, do you have any experience, Dick?" "Nope." But he said, I can do it. I know I can do it." I said, "Did you ever draw cars? Automobiles?" "No, but I can do it." And so I said, "Well, you've got to have something to show. You don't have to have something more to get a job than just a desire to do something. I mean, but you have to show something you can do." He said, "Well, I can't do that," but he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "If you'll make some drawings for me," he said, "I'll take them into Chrysler," and he says, "I'll get a job." He says, "I'll talk my way in." And I said, "Well, I'm not about to do that, Dick. I mean, if you can't make your own drawings, I don't want to see you talk yourself into a job that you can't hold." And he didn't see anything wrong with that. He thought that was a perfectly legitimate request. And I thought, well, this is a strange character. And so he said, how's your love life? You know a lot of girls?" And I said, "Well, I know a few." He said, "Geez," he said, I got all kinds of girls." He said, "I know a couple you really, really like."
He was rather darkly handsome.
Yeah, a real dark guy. He very black mustache, black hair, black eyes.
Yeah.
Very swarthy complexion.
I think he's Armenian, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
Dick Calil. You've heard of him, then you know who I'm talking
about. Yes, right.
So he says, "Oh," he says, I know all these girls," and he said, he says, we'll go out on double dates." And I said, "Well, all right, fix up a date." So I went out on a date with him one time, and he kept bugging me for these drawings.
Mm.
So I thought, well, this is what this guy wants. He wants me to do these drawings and get him into a job he's not qualified for. So I said, "Well, I don't want to have any more to do with him."
Yeah.
And so I told my mother about it, and she said, "Well, I wouldn't do it either. That's not right." So he kept calling me, though. He said, "Well, set up a an appointment with Ray Dietrich for me." He said, "I'll talk my way." He said, "I don't need any drawings." He said, "Just let me get an appointment for me." I said, "I'm not going to do that, Dick." I said, "Forget it."
Yeah,
you know, okay. I couldn't get rid of the guy. And he hounded me for a long time. Finally, I kept ignoring him, and he finally drifted away.
Sure.
So I didn't hear any more about Dick Calil for several years. First thing years later, he has got a quarter-sized clay model of a car that he's showing to George Walker.
Did you run into him at this time?
No. I heard this through other sources, and I can't remember the sources now. But this, as the story goes, The car, the model was done by Bob Cotto in his basement in South Bend. Bob was working at that time for Studebaker. Mm-hmm. And he made this quarter-size model in his basement. And somehow or other, Dick Khalil, who had, I don't know whether he got into Studebaker, was working at Studebaker or not, but he conned Bob Cotto into taking this model mm-hmm. to Detroit mm-hmm. and showing it to Bob, to George Walker, mm-hmm. which he did. Mm-hmm. At that time, Ford was having a lot of problems. They had no car for 49. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what to do. They were in a spot, as it were.
Right.
And along comes George Walker with, here's a finished quarter-size model that he had done. It was George Walker's model. Mm-hmm. They loved it. Mm-hmm. They said, my God, this is our new Ford car. That's so that model, along with George's background at Nash, mm-hmm. he's a consultant at Nash, and they said, well, sure, the model, this all ties in. Dyed-in-the-wool automobile man coming to us with a great idea, so they accepted it, and that was the 49 car. That's got him into Ford, and Dick Khalil wound up with a job at Ford, and I don't know in what capacity. I don't believe it was in styling, mm-hmm. but it was a good job. It was through George Walker.
Mm-hmm. George had reason to be grateful.
Right, right. Well, that was the deal. That Khalil told George, you take this over, you sell it, but I'm going to get something out of this. I can just see the two working, because they're identical people. Only one is light complexion, and the other is dark as hell.
Did one you guy, run into Khalil one, later on at Ford, but you still did?
No, but I did run into him at Chrysler after I had left Ford, and I went to Chrysler. Maybe I may have my facts wrong here. It may not have been Ford that George got him a job with, but it might have been Chrysler that he got him in there. Because by this time, he had connections in all the automobile companies by this,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
And anyway, when I went back to Chrysler, here Dick Khalil is manager of Dodge Truck.
Oh, my gosh.
He's got a damn good job.
Truck design?
Yeah, truck design. Here he is, the same BSer, the same BSer. He's still throwing it in all directions.
20 years later.
20 years later, but that's how Dick Khalil got it.
And how did he do it, the Dodge truck?
Terrible. I mean, the cars the trucks were god-awful looking at the time. And I don't know how long he lasted. I left there in 57. Mm-hmm. I don't know how don't know anything about him since then. But, there was an article in, one of my magazines, the Cars and Parts, I believe, written by punch the button.
So the person you were thinking of was, of course, Bob Thomas.
Yeah. punching again.
So Bob Thomas had written an article in Cars and Parts.
That's right, and Dick Khalil is mentioned in the article, mm-hmm. and his picture is in there too.
Uh-huh. But, what connection?
So he must have had some connection with Ford before he went to Chrysler, and I don't know what it was. As I say, I lost track of the guy, but he must have been rattling around Ford for a while, and then Walker got him in over at Chrysler, and. But that's what reminded me of.
Fascinating. But we should get you back to the late 30s when with this great group. I was going to ask you a bit about some of the people that you mentioned Ted Peach.
Peach.
Tell us a bit about Ted. He's still around.
Yeah.
You probably see him occasionally.
No, I haven't seen Ted. So let me see. Must be 40 years, I guess.
Yeah.
I and we were good friends when he worked at Chrysler there with us.
What was his strong point? What did
he... I'm trying to remember where he, how he came into the department. It must have been about 1939 or 40. I think it was just after Ray Dietrich died. It must have been 40. Anyway, Ted had had been working, I believe, and you can check this with him when you interview him. I think you mentioned you were going to.
Yeah.
For Mr. Hershoff, I believe, who was an engineer in Chrysler at the time, executive engineer, and he had a project, a small car project, that they had, Zeta Scotland Barry had sort of given him this little area, and said, go ahead and see what you can do on a small car. It had nothing to do with Chrysler styling. We didn't have anything to do with it. But he hired Ted, I believe, to do illustrations.
How do you spell Hershoff?
Let me get my pencil out. I'm not sure of the spelling, but I I think it's H-E-R-S-H-O-F-F. And he comes from the Hershoff boat family in New England who have been building boats, I guess, for 100 years or more. There's quite a Hershoff boats, I believe, are still made. They're still a famous boat company.
Mm-hmm.
And Hershoff at Chrysler was, as I say, an executive engineer and had the small car project, and Ted did illustration work for him. And then the project tapered off a bit. And Ted wanted to get into the styling department, so he talked to Ray Dietrich, and Ray hired him, and he worked there with us from about 1940 until I left there in 45, and excellent designer. This great guy. Don't know what else to say about him.
What about Gil Spear? Can you tell us much about him?
Gil started, excuse me, about the same time, I believe. Must have been about 1940. He came from General Motors. He was a General Motors designer. I believe he came about the same time as Tom Bannister. They were both General Motors designers that got caught in the revolving door and came over to Chrysler.
So many of you did.
Yes,
amazing.
Right. And Gil was an excellent designer and illustrator. Came from a artistic family. His father was a well-known artist and illustrator in New York for years and years.
Gil Spear Sr.
And did a lot of automotive advertising illustrations.
He became friendly,
didn't he? Yes, we were very friendly. And then when I left Chrysler, Gil stayed on until about, I think about, must have been about 46 or 47, he went to Ford Motor Company and was responsible for the 49 Lincoln and Mercury designs. Those 2 years were typical of Gil's work. It was recognizable to me as being Gil's
group.
There
were some of these others that briefly that you mentioned here. Herb Newport.
I didn't know too much about Herb Newport. He came to Chrysler about 41, I think, and I didn't know his background at the time at all, and he never talked about it, but I have read in an article not too long ago, and the name of the article and the author escapes me now, but it seems that he was involved with in the classic era in custom body design with a with a body company in New York, I believe.
So Dietrich would have known about that.
Yes, I imagine he would have. But I'm not sure whether Dietrich hired him, because Dietrich left in 40, and I think Herb came in either 40 or 41. Bob Cadwalder took over after after Ray Dietrich left as head of the department. Cadwalder. Yeah. Cadwalder. C-A-D-W-A-L-D-E-R. Bob Cadwalder. And Bob was took over as head of the department after Ray left. And Bob was a an engineering type. He came from the body development drafting section of Chrysler.
What about John Chica or
Chica? Chica? Yeah. John Chica came from General Motors too.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Another
yeah. Yeah, a very interesting guy. He came from Czechoslovakia and came over here with his father about, well, in the early 30s, I believe, and was a stage set designer and illustrator. Did set paintings like that. And then came to Detroit and worked at General Motors, styling, I believe, in the Pontiac studio.
What
and
was his specialty?
He was a an illustrator. Did a lot of illustration work, yes, and design work as well. He stayed with Chrysler until about 1946, when he, when Bob Cadwalder changed jobs, went from Chrysler to Kaiser Motors in Willow Run, Ypsilanti.
Yes.
Bob took John Chica with him as head of the Kaiser design studio.
What about John Hauser?
John Hauser was also.
Can you spell Chica for us?
Chica, C-H-I-K-A.
And Hauser?
J-O-N, capital H-A-U-S-E-R.
Great. Where did he come from?
John? He came from General Motors.
Oh,
yeah, we had a regular General Motors club there.
You mentioned there was a small interior design department under Henry King. Tell us a bit about that at Chrysler in the
latter
30s.
Yes, it had about 8 or 9 people in it, normally, usually. And, yeah, they worked strictly on interiors, instrument panels, and seat design, and hardware, interior hardware.
Who was Henry
King? Henry had been with Chrysler a long time, I believe. Probably as long as Herb Weisinger, and worked in, I think, in color, paint colors and like that, before he took over the interior design department.
Well, he was a natural to have that up.
Yes,
paint
that's right. Yeah, very, very, very talented man. He lives in Florida now, I believe. He's retired. I believe he is. Last I heard, he was.
We were talking about you were doing some outlining of the various designs you worked on at Chrysler. You listed several years and what lines and what types.
Yes. Shortly after I went to Chrysler in 1935, I made a a sketch, one of my drawings, and it was, to my amazement, was practically snatched out of my hands and put into full-size wood mock-up. It was just from my sketch, and it was the 1937 Chrysler design.
Really?
It was the front end, and I had no control over it at all during its development, and it was it wasn't a very good interpretation of what I had in mind, but at least it was my design, and made me feel quite good having just started with a company and having a design accepted like that. It was on the Chrysler 6 line, the Royal line, on the Imperial line, and also on the Airflow. And
what distinguished from the others of the day?
The design, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a little different than most of the things that were going on. It had a rather low horizontal grill. The radiator, radiator shell leaned forward slightly, which no one else was doing. It had had wraparound hood louvers that were die cast that started almost at the center of the car, of the nose of the car, and then wrapped around the sides of the hood to the hood brake where the body starts. And so it was. There was nothing else like it on the road, which was nice. Yeah. And then the following year, I was able to get the 38 DeSoto front end.
Uh-huh. What was the thing about that?
Well, it was another one that was designed as a forward-leaning radiator shell, only more than the Chrysler, farther, more exaggerated lean. And full-size mock-up was really very nice on it. Had a die-cast wrap-around grill. The headlights were mounted in the catwalks and the fenders. And but the actual production car, again, as I say, it actually got through the engineering department, had lost a lot of its character. But
reason to be proud of both.
And then the 1940 Dodge was my front end design. Not very distinctive, but just average. And then the 41 Dodge was again my design. It was one of the first cars, if not the first car, I believe, to have the headlights worked into the grill.
Really? Mm-hmm.
The grill started at the center of the car and swept up out to the ends of the fenders and included the headlights.
So those were fairly satisfying years for you.
Yeah, so my years at Chrysler, plus did a lot of detail designs like bumpers and bumper guards and radiator ornaments.
By this time you were a year to suffer through that in your own motors.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it was quite satisfying because you can go, in that business, you can go a long time without having anything accepted on a car, not even a hubcap. And that gets a little discouraging.
Yeah. But, well, the war comes along and you're caught up in it.
Well, I was at Chrysler during most of the war. During the war, we worked on war projects. We did instruction manuals for tanks and armored vehicles and ambulances and things like that. So most of the styling department what do they call it in those days? Exempted or deferred? Deferment? You had a deferment.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
You were an essential war worker.
Yeah, the essential war worker, so it was deferred. Up until 1944, and I I decided I wanted to see a little bit of what was going on in the war. And so I volunteered into the Merchant Marine.
What better way to see the North Atlantic than
yeah.
naval operation?
Yeah. So I got into the Merchant Marine over the protests of the company. They didn't know why I wanted to go, and after I got in, I wanted the same thing. But I did spend almost a year in the Merchant Marine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then after one of my trips back to the States, I applied for a release from the Merchant Marine, and was told I couldn't get it, and I was in for the duration. But then Chrysler appealed for me. They wanted to give me my job back and said that I was an essential worker, and through their appeal to the draft board, I was reinstated again as a with a deferment, and was released from Merchant Marine. Then I went back with Chrysler, and
this time who was heading up that line?
Bob Cotto, Bob Cadwalder.
Oh, still there.
Was still there. Yeah, and I stayed there until about the end of 1945, and then went to out to Los Angeles, where I wanted to try my hand at industrial design. I wanted to get away from automobiles for a little while. And went to Los Angeles and with a bunch of samples.
And so what did you gravitate toward?
Well, I tried the two existing industrial design offices in Los Angeles, Walter Dorwin Teague office and the Raymond Loewy office, and neither one of them had openings, and so I did some freelance work for a little while for an advertising agency, and also for a tractor company. I did a couple of designs for a tractor company, and then I landed a job at Lockheed Aircraft Corporation in Burbank. And I set up a one-man design department. It later grew to three. And we did airplane interiors for the Navy and Army brass executive airplanes, and. Then worked on projected jet airline interiors, and even worked on a presidential airplane, a Lockheed Constellation, which was kind of a story in itself.
Let's hear a little bit about it.
Well, they came to me with this project, Lockheed Management.
Uh-huh.
They wanted this interior for Constellation to be used by Mr. Dewey when he was elected.
Mm-hmm.
This is in 1948.
This is the famous slender fuselage, three-tailed.
That's right. The bent fuselage and the three vertical.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. The Connie, they called it.
Right. So in anticipation of Dewey becoming president.
Yes, and I don't know who was paying for the airplane, but it was probably somebody in the. In the Pentagon, along with Lockheed, they were probably going to grease the ways a little bit.
Or heads their bets.
Yeah, because.
Like Truman was on the way up. But.
Well, they thought he was. I mean, he was president. He had taken over when Franklin D. died, so he was just a kind of a lame duck president, and they thought he would be defeated, that Dewey would get the election. So they wanted to have this airplane nice and new and all ready to go for President Dewey, have it down on the runway when he was elected, to say, see what we've done for you, Mr. Dewey, and how about some Lockheed contracts? Anyway, as everybody knows, it backfired, and Truman beat him very roundly at the polls. And the airplane was already in Washington. at the airport.
Oh, it all fitted out, ready to go.
Oh yes, yes. Okay. But what happened? What happened halfway through the project? I didn't say. As I got halfway through the project, and the two fellows working with me, one of the men in management came to me and said that they were going to have to take the job to Raymond Loewy in New York. That this was to be a very classy airplane, and they wanted to have Raymond Loewy's name attached to it. They said it was, they were satisfied with the way the interior was going, but they wanted the Loewy name. And
well, you've been released by the Merchant Marine, and the World War II is over, and you're planning to come back to Chrysler.
Now let's see. I went to Lockheed, right?
Oh,
went to Lockheed.
I bet you've already been. That's right.
And
you were telling us about the.
Did we finish about the Constellation for
Dewey? No, you were telling us about the Constellation at Lockheed. Now the Lockheed experience must have been fascinating for you. All sorts of interior work and.
Well,
and airplanes, and which gave you the background for your present occupation.
Yes, yes, it did, and it was very interesting. Although it wasn't automobiles, which was my first love.
Right. Yeah. But you were telling us about the abortive.
The Constellation for Dewey.
Presidential Constellation.
Yes.
Yes.
The airplane, as I say, was taken over by the Loewy group and finished up with the Loewy nameplate on it.
Why was that done?
Well, the Lockheed management wanted the prestige of a famous designer's name on the mm-hmm. airplane.
Yes.
So it carried just that much more weight with President Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And Lockheed had lost a lot of their war work at that time. They wanted more work, and they're practically the biggest defense contractor in the country now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they make their money is on playing the ball with the Pentagon.
Right.
So this was one of their early attempts
mm-hmm.
at bettering up the powers that be. And
yes,
so,
almost everybody in the country have thought that Tom Dewey was going to be.
Oh, really? Yes, yes. The newspapers had all
the headlines
all printed. Dewey wins by landslide and all that. Anyway, old Harry came out.
He certainly did.
Fat and happy.
Fantastic.
And the airplane was already delivered to the Washington D.C. airport and all ready for Mr. Dewey's approval. And one of the first things that Harry did was to see this airplane on the tarmac there and want to know who the hell's airplane that was.
Oh no!
Who it was for?
Who had the chair telling you?
I don't know.
No,
I don't know how it ever came out. But that we got just a little feedback from at Lockheed, but not very much. It was hushed up. Very. I don't even know whatever happened to the airplane.
Oh, he didn't use it.
Oh no! In fact, he said we got this from one of the people that was there, one of the engineering,
mm-hmm.
that he said, I'm not going to set foot on an airplane, and he never did. He said, I'm going to use the Independence, and he said, that's mm-hmm. good enough for me.
And so
I don't need a fancy airplane.
What happened to the Dewey Constellation?
I don't know. Nobody ever knows. I never found out. And
brought back to California.
It probably was brought back, and the interior ripped out and sold to an airline or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was a very embarrassing thing for Lockheed, and they wanted to forget it as soon as possible.
Now, that story hadn't been told by too many people.
Not really.
That's fascinating.
No, yeah. I thought it was kind of a cute little story.
It certainly is.
Because buttering up somebody like that to that expense, and then having it backfire,
typical of Harry Truman, he said, "I'm not going to fly that down there."
No.
Who did the Independence?
I don't know.
It wasn't Lockheed.
No, that was a Douglas.
Douglas. I think Lockheed lost out for several years.
Well, Douglas and Lockheed were big competitors for years. You know, they They were trying to get the business. They were trying to get the government business. And this was going to be their foot in the door.
Their entree,
this beautiful airplane for Mr. Dewey all ready to go. And with Mr. Lowy's name playing, not my name on it, but Mr. Lowy's name.
Thank God it wasn't your name playing on it. That was fascinating. How come you left Lockheed?
Well, I worked there until 1950, and then Bill Flagel, my old friend at Briggs and Chrysler, in the meantime had been freelancing design at Detroit, and he had landed a consulting contract with George Mason at Nash Motors. And this was after the after Don Mortrud was there. You know.
And had Mortrud left?
Had Mortrud had left, yeah.
Now Mason,
Walker was out, Mortrud had left, and Ed Anderson, I believe, was in charge of that from GM, yeah.
Now at this time, George Mason had parlayed Nash and Calvinator into a conglomerate known as American Motors.
They hadn't changed the name yet.
Oh, hadn't they?
No, it's still Nash. Nash and Calvinator, yeah.
Yeah. But he was branching out beyond Nash and into other areas.
Yeah, yeah. They had been in the Calvinator business for some time at that point.
Fairly prosperous, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Done some war work, some defense work.
That's right. Yeah,
they
were doing very well. And George Romney was his second command, right. And that's who we dealt with, basically. But Bill had landed this consulting job with him, and he called me in L.A. and wanted to know if I'd like to come back and work with him on the project.
But you'd moved your family out to Los Angeles for about.
Well, I wasn't married then. I had been married and divorced by this time.
Okay, all right.
So I was footloose.
You're still single.
Right. So I said, sure. Sounds good. It was more money. I was making a Lockheed, and it was automobiles again, which I wanted, and I would get back to Detroit. So I left sunny California and went back to Detroit, and we worked on the...
Did we establish why you left Chrysler in 45?
I think we covered that. I wanted to get into industrial design.
Yeah, okay, good. Yes, we did.
Get away from cars a little bit.
Right, yeah. What was the deal then with Bill Flagel and his consultancy with Nash Motors?
Yeah, we worked on the Nash Metropolitan, that little car.
Tell us a little bit about that. That's a fascinating episode, isn't it?
Yeah, that.
How'd it come about?
Well, they wanted to. They had some tie-in with English Motors, and they had this small engine they wanted to use.
What was the name of the company?
The English company.
Yeah.
I don't remember now. I can't recall it. Mason had this idea about a small car. He thought it was a timely thing, and so.
Been too many American small cars. Huh?
No. And so we.
Crosley, the Henry J.
And none of them successful because people at that time didn't want small cars.
Right.
Gasoline was 20 cents a gallon.
Right.
Who the hell needed a small car, you know? So, we did that and did...
He had this tie-in, he had a motor from Britain, and did you and Bill Fitzgerald come up with the Metropolitan design?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating little car. Yeah, it was a nice design.
Yeah, it was a cute little design. And
becoming a classic, really.
Pretty bulbous now when you look at it.
But
it had some good features on it.
Friend of mine,
low hood, very drop hood, with a nice pontoon fenders going all the way through them. And nice little oval grille and bumper combination. And worked on all that.
How many did they make of those? How many years was the production?
I don't remember now. 50. I don't know, maybe 5 years. I'm not quite sure.
They sold recently.
Not too bad. No, it wasn't a disaster or anything, but we worked on the big Nash. Pininfarina was also a consultant at that time too. Nash.
Yes, the famous
Italian.
The famous Nash. He had done one for them, I think, 49 or 50.
Now that this is one that that he worked on. It was a 52.
That's right. Spell his name for us.
Pinin, capital F A R I N A. Pinin Farina. Now I understand they're running it all together, Pinin Farina.
Yes, that was a nickname. Pinin, I think, was a nickname. And his real name is something like Giuseppe or something.
That's right, very Giuseppe.
But now he runs it all together.
All together, yeah. The son and the grandsons, yeah.
Right.
But, we worked at the same time. Both had a showing of our cars at the same time.
Really?
It was really pretty bad, if I just say so.
Yeah.
Ours was not that good, but they took ours, and then he did some work on it, and it was not to any benefit at all.
Mm.
And the car turned out to be too bulbous again, and he didn't know how to design regular cars. I mean, he can design a car that's 48 or 50 inches high,
right.
You know, I don't want to buy a cost no object, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if it comes to doing a car that has to carry a family around,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a milk can or two,
mm-hmm.
he was out of his depth.
Yeah.
So he really didn't contribute anything. But when the car came out, it was designed by Pinin Farina, and they even had his name on it. But it was mostly Clay Joe Miller car.
What was the setup in Nationals?
We were very proud of it. It wasn't very good.
What year was that?
It was 52.
52, yeah. What was the setup of Nash in those days? George Mason was still the patriarch of the company, but he had this ambitious young assistant who he'd worked with during the war. His name was
George Romney.
George sort of really ran things, didn't he?
Yeah, he was the spark plug. Mason was a good old time automobile man and a good executive. He was a good executive,
yeah.
But he left the day to day operations mostly to George Mason. Yeah,
George Romney.
I mean, George Romney. George Romney. Mason came over to our office to see designs several times, but it was mostly George Romney and his engineers that came over to our
office. The Flagelli Miller office was nearby.
Yeah, it was on Schaefer. I forget the number now. On Schaefer Road.
And of course the Nash Calvinator building, which is still there, was over on
Plymouth.
What?
Plymouth?
Plymouth Road, that's
Plymouth
right.
Road.
Plymouth Road, yeah. And it's still there at the AMC headquarters.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, my old friend Dick Teague was
right.
Head of design there. He just retired.
Just recently retired, yes.
Yeah.
So you were, the 52 didn't turn out so well, and then the collaboration with Pinin Farina was less than. Solicitous, but you stayed on, you pressed on.
Well, you're not going to, show the contract, and you're still working on,
yeah.
on future designs. We
right.
did a lot of future stuff for them. But some of the things were adapted, like a couple of front ends, the hood design, where the hood is lower than the fenders, this type of thing.
Yes.
A drop in the belt line, this feature was carried over.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked with Bill there until about 53, I guess, 50 to 53.
A harmonious relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah, we got along very well.
Good
and, yeah.
But it was, but working at that type of design work, when you were somewhat removed from the final product, even though it was your design, was that a bit... frustrating at times.
I mean, as a consultant rather than in-house.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you didn't feel. It has its advantages and disadvantages.
Right.
The advantage is that you are away from the corporate headquarters.
True.
You don't have the guy breathing down your neck all the time, telling you how he wants it.
And you could.
You get it ready, and then you show it to him, which is nice.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you don't. You don't feel as much of a part of it because they can cut you off at any time. You don't have any real tie to the company
right.
like you do if you're on a
yeah.
salary there.
Yeah, you're on a retainer basis. How does that work?
Yeah.
You get paid by the job or
no? There's a yearly retainer and then an hourly rate of
actual work,
different
done.
Work that you do on different projects. Yeah.
Did you have anyone else in the office besides you two? Or did you
have yeah, there were different times. There was one or two other designers, and then there was a clay modeler. I did clay modeling as well as design, and everybody does something. You know, you all pitch in and do whatever you.
Did you have the facilities right there, or did you rent facilities elsewhere before?
No, we had. Well, we made clay models there,
and
plaster and clay models and plaster models. We had no metal facilities or anything like that, but we did design work and model work. Yeah.
Final place.
Yeah. And then I got a call one day. A call from
another old friend.
Yeah.
Who was that?
From Gordon Buehring.
Oh, really?
And
had you met him and worked
and
with him in the entire career?
Not really. I never have known Gordon very well, but we know of each other. I guess that's how it is.
Your reputation's in.
Yeah, evidently. Because one time, just before I went to California, after when I was working at Chrysler, before this must have been in 45, late 45, Gordon called me. He was working in South Bend for Raymond Loewy at the time. And he said, Loewy is looking for somebody to go to England to take over the English design office there.
Loewy.
In London.
Office.
Yeah. And Loewy was doing a couple of cars. Sunbeam was one, and Morris Minor
right.
was the other, I believe.
Yeah.
And looking for somebody to go over there and head that thing up. And there was one fellow that was over there from GM, but he was coming home. Looking for somebody, and he said, Gordon said, I've recommended you, and how he got my name, I don't know. I don't ever remember meeting him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, they will pay your way down in the expenses down in New York for the interview, and blah, blah. So I went, and I met Raymond Loewy there in the New York office. And they outlined the job, and the fellow that was coming back from England at the time was there in the office that day, and he was a GM designer, and I can't remember his name now, but I didn't know him, but I knew of him. Anyway, we went out and had lunch together after my interview with Loewy, and then he told me about the tough situation in London. He says, you can't get any place to live. Food is, you know, expensive, the clothes are expensive, everything
right
is.
After the war,
yeah. Yeah, and it's Jesus, it's terrible.
Who would that have been?
I'm just right on the tip of my tongue.
Did he later go on to something?
Did
he stay in
the auto industry? God, I don't know what I remember. What was his name? Right on the tip of my tongue. He was one of the key men at GM. Frank Hershey would probably know who he was. Anyway, he was in Loewy's office, I think, over there about
we'll
a year.
We'll insert his name later when you think of it.
Hmm?
We'll insert his name
yeah,
later.
If I ever think of it again. Been years since I thought of this.
London thing. Was just practically still a bombed out city, wasn't it? Right?
Yeah.
No
sure.
housing. Really.
Yeah. So that didn't sound very good to me, and so one of the other men that interviewed me there, I can't think of his name either. He was Barney, anyways, Loewy's right hand man.
Barney
so
Russell, is it?
No, Barney.
Yeah, we can tell his name.
Anyway, I called him the next day. I stayed in New York the other day. I called him the next day and I said, well, I didn't think that I would be interested. I had already planned to go to California, Los Angeles.
Right.
So I already planned that, and I said, I think that's what I'm going to do. So I almost thought of his name. Anyway, they eventually found somebody to go, I guess. But that time, Gordon, getting back to Gordon Buehring,
yes.
He's well recommended for that job, but I don't, I don't think I'd ever met him at the time. Then he called me on this job with Johnny Reinhart was setting up this separate design division to do the Continental Mark II. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a separate division of Ford, and that had. So we met for lunch anyway, and we're at Cliff Bell's. Remember Cliff Bell's on Six Mile Road?
Good.
We had lunch.
The Cliff Bell's, I knew it was downtown on Grand.
One downtown and one on Six Mile Road.
One on 6 Mile, I never knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Good restaurants.
Oh, yeah. Yes. We went and met at the one on 6 Mile Road because my apartment was right practically around the corner in that woods, they call it there.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, they outlined it and it sounded great. You know, it was going to be a prestige car and you're only going to sell to certain people, and it's going to cost $10,000, which is an astronomical price for a car in those days. Mm-hmm. This was in 53, latter part 52, maybe 53.
They'd gotten the go-ahead by then.
Oh, yeah. And they were ready to set this thing at home, and they were going to have their own production line. It was a separate mm-hmm. entity, and it sounded marvelous. So would I be interested in a consulting basis? And they were going to have three other outside consultants. There were going to be four total. Mm-hmm. Vince Gardner was going to be one. There would be one. And I think there was an industrial design company in downtown Detroit that was going to be the other one. There might have been two others or three that I can't remember now. And we were to make... three, we could make one proposal if we wanted to, or we could make three, but no more than three. And they had to be a certain size. They gave us the grids to work on, had to be a certain perspective. They all had to be alike, the perspectives. Front three-quarter, rear three-quarter, side view. They all had to be rendered in blue. They wanted all the same colors, all the same views, so that nobody could outclass somebody else in the way of rendering or trick up a rendering so that, you know, sort of a real exotic view or something. Mm-hmm. And then they had their own styling section, so there was going to be, I guess there's three outsiders and their own interior, in-house design group. And we were to get $10,000 for this presentation.
That's pretty good.
You could even get one car, or you could do three, but no more than three. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to set up my own design office. Mm-hmm. And have Ford as a client, not too bad. Mm-hmm. So I called Buzz Grissinger, and he was at Kaiser Fraser at the time.
Oh, was he?
And the fact they were just kind of winding up. He had just done this 54, Buzz designed the front end on this 54 Kaiser I have here.
Did he really?
And they were just winding that up, and Kaiser was getting kind of shaky, and so I said, how about let's go in partnerships and setting up an industrial design office. We've got a Ford contract here that we can start off with. So he thought about it a couple of days, and he said, well, that sounds good to me. And so so he quit Kaiser, and we opened a little office out in Pleasant Hill. Not Pleasant Hill, Pleasant Ridge.
Oh, yeah.
You know, nice. By Royal Oak there?
Sure.
Right on Woodward Avenue.
Part of that is being torn up by the expressway.
All right. So we set up shop there, and it had a good-looking little office. It was like a storefront, but it was new, and it was had a big plate glass window in the front, which I'm kind of leading up to something here.
Yes.
And that was a reception area, and they had a nice reception area, and then a conference room, and then in the back was a workshop and the clay modeling facilities and all. And so we started on that project and submitted two designs. And during the, I guess it was over a period of maybe 4 months, during that period, the chief engineer of this new Continental Division and William Clayford came over to our office to see, get a preview of what we were doing.
Who was the chief engineer?
Can't remember his name.
Carly Cott.
That's
still in this area somewhere. Yeah.
Huh? Is he out here?
He's still around. He's in the Bay Area. Yeah.
Harley Cobb, yeah. And William Clay Ford. Mm-hmm. They would come over. They came over a couple of times, and one time they drove a Mercedes convertible that William Clay had, the big one. They drove that over, and we went out for a spin in that. And another time, they had driven over in, I don't know, a Lincoln or something. And this was a storefront building, and it was new. And this big plate glass window in front, and they hadn't put the sidewalk in. It only came so far, and they hadn't put a sidewalk in right, well, there's just a little one right in front of the door. And the rest of, and there was angle parking, see? And cars would come up, and they'd come almost into that plate glass window because there was no curb there. See? Oh. It was plenty of room to park, but they knew it was up pretty close. Mm-hmm. So we were, there was Harley Cobb, Ford, and Buzz and I, and we were sitting in the reception area, right in front of this window, and they were just getting ready to leave, or we were just talking there, I guess.
Right.
And this new Cadillac convertible comes roaring up, and it comes right up and does the same thing that a lot of these, and we were getting, it kind of annoyed me that people would get up so close to that window. And this Cadillac swished up there and just like stopped in front of this window. And I looked out and I said, some of these fool drivers, I said, somebody's going to come right through that plate glass window one of these days. And William Ford says, oh, he says, I'm sorry. He says, that's for me. He says, that's for me.
<It's a> Cadillac?
And it was some friend of his picking them up. They were going up skiing.
Oh, no.
But I said, some fool is going to come right through that window while the way these people drive around here. He went, of course, oh, I'm sorry. He says, that's for me. He says, he went out and excused himself, went out and talked to him. And then he left shortly after that.
Yeah.
But I felt like a fool myself because I had to shoot my mouth off in front of him. And it was his, somebody picking him up.
Interestingly that Cop and he were interested in your design. You must have come close to... in the competition?
Well, I don't know how close we came. Everybody had completed their presentations and submitted them, they chose the one that was done in their own studio, you know, at Jenna and Johnny Weinhardt. And
I think I have a large notebook up in the archive showing all the competing designs.
Oh, is that right?
So some of your sketches must
be up
there.
Yeah, yeah.
When I get back, I'll take a look.
Yeah,
see,
sure.
Maybe I can send you some.
I made a little model downstairs of one of them.
Did you?
And I, it's just the side view, and I have it down there. It's just a little scale, 12 scale plaque type. It just shows the side of the car all in relief. And I have that.
Very interesting design.
Yeah, I'll show you that. I'll bring that model up and
okay.
Take a look at it.
Mr. Miller is showing me a half. How would you describe
that? Well, it's a plaque type model.
What was that word again?
Plaque.
Okay.
Like a wall plaque.
Plaque.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a scale model, but it's plaque. It's not the full. It doesn't have the full width of the car.
What scale is it?
I think it's 1/12.
1/12. Yeah. And this was one of the competing designs for the 1956 Mark II, right?
That's it.
Yeah. And from what I can see, and from what I've seen of the others, this was probably this may well have been right up there in the finals. There were.
I hope it wasn't.
Yeah.
I didn't see the other competing designs.
As I remember seeing them, from materials that we have at the archives, that this I think was the closest to the one design in terms of acceptability of the final design.
Well, it was a fun project. We enjoyed it, and
the
Pentecost started, and then I just made this for my own. For my own amusement after the project was finished.
It was over.
Yes.
Using your design.
Yeah, this was not in the presentation. The model wasn't in the presentation. Because you couldn't present models.
That's right. They just wanted
drawings.
Drawings or anything.
So,
when did you find out that you hadn't gotten it? How did it come about? Who let you know?
I think it was Harley Kopp. Yeah, he was our contact, our real hunt contact. Yeah. And
what did he say?
I don't remember now. I think it was probably in the form of a letter.
Oh, a letter. He didn't come over and talk.
I don't know. He might have come over, but I just don't recall that.
Yeah. Were you somewhat disappointed? You thought it was good design?
Oh, yeah. We,
your
thoughts
were a little...
Yeah, yeah.
Would have been a good account.
We had... Oh, yes, it would have. We had two... We submitted two designs, and they were both rather times. Nice-looking cars, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But shortly after that... the chief engineer of Kaiser called Buzz, and wanted to know if we'd be interested in doing some consulting work for Kaiser.
Mm-hmm.
So we took that on. We were going to do. They were thinking about bringing out a new Kaiser car for 56 or 57. I don't remember which. And then they wanted a rework on the Kaiser Willys car. They had just taken over the Willys, bought Willys.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So we went to work for them then, right after this
mm-hmm.
kind of project, and that lasted for about a year. We did a lot of drawings, and we did a. We worked. Buzz and I worked out at Willow Run, in a studio that was set up for us. We had a complete.